Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to the CBSSports.com College Football Podcast. I am Chip Patterson, and we are just 3 weeks away from the kickoff of the college football season. We've been waiting and waiting, and here we will finally have action on the gridiron. No more speculation, no more prognostication. All we will have is just dirt and grit right there between the hash marks. And today we're going to be talking a little Heisman. It's never too early to talk the Heisman. And I'm very, very pleased to introduce Chris Houston, the Heisman Pundit, founder of HeismanPundit.com, and now the newest CBSSports.com national college football blogger. Chris, how have you enjoyed your first couple weeks working with the Eye on College Football?
Yeah, it's been great so far. Everyone's made me very, very welcome, and it's been great to get my feet wet and start getting down and dirty with college football again, and to hopefully find a wider audience for my rather unorthodox views on everything from the Heisman to everything else college football.
Well, your unorthodox views that you mentioned, it's actually really one of the things that's led you here. And for the listeners that might not be familiar with Heisman Pundit, you can follow him on Twitter, HeismanPundit.com. It's been his website for the last, I guess, like 4 or 5 seasons, right? Maybe longer?
Eight. This is actually my 8th season.
8 seasons. Okay, well, so take the listeners back. This started early 2000s at Southern Cal, correct?
I actually started out at the sports information director, or an assistant sports information director at USC in early 1999, and started working with football team then, and started under Paul Hackett, and eventually transitioned into Pete Carroll. So I was there up until 2005, through the whole kind of seesaw gamut of, USC with being really moribund as a program under Paul Hackett, and then kind of changing into sort of the elite program of that decade under Pete Carroll.
And during this time, you were there for Carson Palmer and Matt Leinart, correct?
Correct. What really changed from my perspective was the Carson Palmer year when I was involved with promoting him for the Heisman. And what it really was for me was an education on the way the Heisman process worked. It really fascinated me because it seemed to me like a strange mixture of PR and politics and sports. And this all just kind of fascinated and tickled my fancy. So I sort of ruminated about what ran the Heisman or what sort of guided the Heisman. And I came up with these guidelines. And 2 years later, Matt Leinart ran for USC, and I say ran like he's a candidate, but he was a candidate. And,
it's absolutely a political campaign. No, I agree with you
right there. Yeah, so it's very much a political campaign. So in 2004, with these ideas in mind, we ran this campaign for Leinart. And, I don't claim to think that campaigns are the critical portion of what determines the Heisman winner. The players obviously have to perform on the field. But it was still all about observing the way the voters reacted to what he did and what we said about him. And that was a very, very interesting education on my behalf. So from that, I devised what I called the 10 Heismanments. I actually first called them, said casually to a friend of mine, hey, these are these 10 commandments I'm going to create for how the Heisman race is ruled. And he goes, well, why don't you call them the 10 Heismanments? And I said, that kind of has a good ring to it. So I did that, and pretty much since then I've been looking at the race more from a philosophical perspective. When I released CBSSports.com's top 10 earlier this week, I get the regular feedback of people sort of saying, oh, you can't put that guy here because this player is better than the other, or this player is better than this player. But, the point for me isn't to decide which player is best. It's to figure out how are the voters going to vote. What's going to influence the voters to vote in one direction or another. So my philosophy when it comes to creating a preseason Heisman watch or in analyzing the race is looking at the race how it is and not how I want it to be. So I try to look at it through that prism.
Yeah, no, absolutely, because we've reached a point, and if you think about the Heisman Trophy, you know, awarded to the most outstanding player in college football, you know, that is such a broad stroke in a sport that all we do is meticulously break down every single angle. So it would be impossible to actually decide that. It seems to me, and one of the reasons I've always loved, you know, obviously I've followed your work, and it's looking at, you know, why these things are happening, not necessarily predicting what's going to happen. And I know you've got the straw poll that you'll do as the season goes of Heisman voters. But you know, it's very tough in college football, a sport that is so, so big and is looked at from so many different angles, to even make a declaration as great as identifying one player who sticks out among the rest.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to do, and it's influenced all by, you know, how everyone sort of argues about every little thing in college football. And I've said this to many people in the past, and that, you know, one of the things that governs college football, it's what governs, you know, the love of your team and the love of your conference, the love of a certain player, is this fear that you're about to get screwed. You know, whether it's by the polls, whether it's by the BCS, whether it's by the Heisman voters. So this is what sort of animates the fans and animates the discussions around all these events. But the voters themselves, I think, are in their own way influenced by these discussions. And I think over the years, if you look at what kind of players they voted for the Heisman, you'll see a very distinct pattern based on, you know, which schools these guys play for, what positions they play, and what kind of stats they produce. And once you look at those patterns, you're able to sort of whittle down, you know, not so much who's going to win, but it's actually whittling it down to who's definitely not going to win or who doesn't really have much of a shot. And so once you get to that point and you can whittle it down to a few more guys, then you could start to analyze things from a better perspective.
What were some of the things that you think really played in Robert Griffin III's favor last year, certain angles that sort of helped him run away with the trophy?
Well, I actually think the Heisman race is changing a little bit the last two or three years, and I think a big part of that is the advent of social media and Twitter and Facebook and just the internet and the instantaneous dispersal of news and information about players and teams. And this has sort of created, just like in the real world with the 24-hour news cycle, almost is becoming like a five-hour news cycle now. It's sort of happening this way with college football. So with Robert Griffin III, I think it was the way his style of play was really appealing to voters. I think the fact that he was able to take a program that had never been relevant in college football and to make it relevant, or at least, you know, legitimate enough to beat the likes of Oklahoma and Texas for the first time in their history, and his ability to shatter some previous passing efficiency marks, which had been held by some pretty good players, all those things sort of conspired and came together to make him sort of the player of the season. And I've always said that the player who wins the Heisman is sort of the guy who captures, you know, the zeitgeist of that year. It's the spirit of that year. And I think he just sort of rode that wave. And I think he was the right guy at the right time. And it's really hard to predict, you know, who's going to catch that wave. But if, when you see things developing, that's what a good Heisman analyst notices.
That's right, because, you know, like you said, it's the spirit of the season. And heading into last season, as we got underway, everyone's luck, Richardson, luck, Richardson, luck, Richardson. But at the end of the year, neither one of them really represented what college football was all about. And it seemed to me like last year, you know, these wild and crazy games, really that was what the college football fans seemed to rally behind. You know, it was these big late night sort of comeback victories, especially in the Big 12 and the Pac 12, seemed to be what your trendy college football fan was really able to get behind. And obviously those shootouts with Robert Griffin III and that Oklahoma game, I think that was sort of what separated him. Whereas, you know, Richardson was a model of consistency, you know, the entire season. But, you know, all the college football fans around the nation didn't really rally behind Alabama.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think Baylor did a great job of controlling the narrative of what it meant for what he was doing. The Baylor Sports Information Department, they put out great amounts of information in a creative way that let people know, hey, this is what it meant when Robert Griffin III did, or this is what he's doing. And so it was a, I think Stanford and lost control of the narrative for Luck, and this is where the campaigns come in. And, he came in as the guy who was the preseason favorite and going to be the first pick in the draft and, one of the great quarterbacks ever. And they sort of rested on those laurels, and next thing you know, a very good case is being made for Robert Griffin III, and I think that's when you have the big shift.
Yeah. Well, let's we've got 2011 behind us. Let's go through and start looking at 2012. Now, the Heisman watch has already been posted on CBSSports.com. You can go there, see breakdowns of Chris's top 10 players to watch, as well as some other ones to keep an eye on. But what we're going to do is we're going to run down his top five. And Chris, for each one, I'd like to hear one thing that could work in this candidate's favor and one thing that could work against him. One thing could keep him from getting that stiff arm trophy. All right, number five, you've got Aaron Murray, quarterback from Georgia. What do you see as the best thing going for Aaron Murray?
The best thing going for Aaron Murray is that he has sort of a magical ability to sort of transcend the limitations that he has in the Georgia offense. If you look at the history of the Georgia offense the last, 10 years or so under Mark Richt, they haven't really been able to put up great passing numbers for quarterbacks. And part of that is just the style of play that Georgia relies upon. And I think his ability to transcend that, really reflects well on him. And also, if you look at Georgia's schedule, they've got a chance, because of their schedule, to really stay within the national title conversation for a while.
What's going to be one thing that could be working against Aaron Murray?
Well, as a kind of flip side to my previous point, that would probably be Mark Richt. Mark Richt doesn't really believe in kind of chucking the ball in the air as many times as he can or playing to those strengths. He believes in a balanced offense, and he believes in running the ball and grinding it out. It's sort of, playing it safe. And I think Aaron Murray is the kind of guy who's kind of overcome that. But I also think that, potentially he could be held back by Rick's offense. So I think that is the one thing that is not working in his favor. And also, not having depth at running back could also be a factor.
And it's interesting you say that because you could even argue, I haven't thought of this before, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but that could be one of the reasons why you look at Matt Stafford all of a sudden, now that he's got obviously Calvin Johnson helps, but he's sitting back there and just chucking it for almost 400 yards a game sometimes, and that we never really got to see that a lot at Georgia.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the guy who's the first pick in the draft. And, Matthew Stafford, great, huge recruit, by all accounts, a very talented guy. And, if you go looking back, through his numbers, in 2008, he had 25 touchdown passes his senior year. And that was his high water mark. Now, Aaron Murray has come out and he threw 35 touchdown passes last year as just a sophomore. And I think that really is a tribute to his ability to sort of overcome the limitations of that offense. And I think if you look back, and again, that's 35 touchdowns is a school record, I believe, for Georgia. So, it took Aaron Murray to sort of overcome, those limitations. And, it wasn't enough. Matthew Stafford couldn't throw 35 touchdown passes, but Aaron Murray could in that system. So I think that's a tribute to Aaron Murray's ability and sort of how he transcends any type of system.
Moving on to number four. Speaking of systems, we've got Landry Jones. What do you think? One thing going for Landry and one thing that is working against him?
Well, going for him is the fact that he plays for a traditional power like Oklahoma and that he plays in that kind of system that just puts up huge numbers. The guy's got over 12,000 passing yards in 3 years. So, this is a guy who's going to put up big numbers. He's going to put up a lot of touchdown passes. He's going to throw the ball a lot. So, when Heisman voters look at the stats at the end of the season. You know, they're not going to look at Landry Jones and say, wow, he didn't really do anything. Most likely, if he has a good year, and this is all assuming, you know, players live up to their potential. You know, if he has a good year, people are going to be impressed by his numbers. Now, the question is going to be, you know, what do these numbers mean? And, you know, do these numbers, you know, develop into wins on Oklahoma's behalf, or are they going to just be sort of empty numbers of the sort we've seen the last couple of years? So, but what he does have going for him is that Oklahoma is a traditional Heisman power. When you are a quarterback or a running back for Oklahoma, voters tend to give you more leeway, and that's definitely a big thing in his favor.
Yeah, no, I think that is one of the most interesting of the Heismanments is if you are the top player on one of maybe a dozen traditional powers, you automatically put yourself into that top five, top ten of the Heisman conversation just by being at that school.
Yeah, and I compare that a lot to in my recent article to a presidential campaign. If you are a governor of California or Texas or a senator from Florida or from one of the major states, you sort of start out from a higher level than a candidate who might hail from Montana or from Georgia. Now, you get a situation where you have obviously great name recognition and you've got great fundraising ability and you're probably in major media markets. All those factors play into you know, the political side of things. And so if you're from one of those states in the realm of politics, you're going to have a better shot or at least a better starting off point by which to gain a nomination or which to win an election. Now, obviously, just as in sports, in politics, you still need skill and talent and luck as a politician to, you know, to clinch that victory. But those are the things that we really can't, document or quantify going into a situation. So if you flip that back over to college football, you've got the USC's and the Notre Dame's and the Oklahoma's and, you know, Texas and Michigan and Ohio State. Once you start out from one of those schools, you may not do anything the previous year, but if you might have three games under your belt and you've done well, you're suddenly a Heisman candidate. And a great example of that would be, you know, Denard Robinson as a sophomore when he started out like gangbusters. And, you know, he was, you know, pretty much at the top of the Heisman race for a little while. So, and this was a guy who had barely played the year before. Now, if he had done those same things at Iowa State, people would have said, oh, what a nice player, but they wouldn't have been considering him for the Heisman.
They'd call him the next Seneca Wallace.
Exactly.
And working against Landry Jones, and one thing that comes to my mind is just obviously, you know, we saw a drop off after Broyles got hurt. They've got a lot of injuries along the offensive line. It seems like the health of his teammates and the status of his teammates is going to be something that a lot of people are going to be looking for.
Yeah, that's definitely the downside for Jones. I don't think he has that superstar receiver, which they've had if you look the last, you know, 10 years of Oklahoma teams, the Mark Claytons and the Joaquin Iglesias and the Broyles. So, you know, they've always had that one great receiver to sort of carry the load. And I see Kenny Stills as not that number one guy, but as that number two guy in relation to those others. So I think it's going to be hard for Jones to put up that dynamic type of season that people expect. And, you know, this is a guy who followed Sam Bradford. So Sam Bradford sort of set the standard right there for that system. So it's going to be hard to break through. One other thing to consider, and it's something that I was trying to articulate in the article, but it sort of got cut out. And that is, I still think that Blake Bell, who's his backup, has this outside chance of becoming a factor in that more of a factor in that offense. And possibly even if it comes to a situation where Jones isn't performing, I wouldn't be shocked to see a guy like Blake Bell take more snaps or eventually start at some point in the season, just because it's the nature of coaches to want to go with a guy who's going to be the starter the previous year and, you know, get him the experience. So I actually think that Blake Bell, if not this year, down the line is going to be a ridiculously valid Heisman Trophy candidate.
Blake Bell, throw that one on your futures list. Let's get some money behind him. On to number three, we got Wisconsin running back Mr. Touchdown Monty Ball.
Ball.
Monte Ball. That's right. He's putting the accent. Is that on the first or second E?
I'm not sure. I'll put him on both if I have to.
But what do you like about Ball, especially as he's coming back?
Well, he's got great name recognition. He's the leading returning Heisman vote getter, so he's very familiar to the voters. And that's a big part of building your base of support, is it's familiarity with the voters. Just, you know, you look at guys like Chip Patterson or Matt Hinton and all these guys, and Stu Mandel and Bruce Feldman, all these, we all know who all these players are. And if you're a Heisman voter and you're one of those people who follows things on a national level, you're going to know who all these guys are. But say you're the beat writer for Michigan State, and you're grinding away working on the Spartans, but you've got a Heisman vote. You're spending your Saturday in, East Lansing, up in the press box, and you're kind of getting everything else by hearsay. So some player emerges out in the Southwest, and you don't get to watch as many of his games, and maybe you're not getting to watch as many highlights, and you've got a two-year-old screaming at you. So, what you do is over time, you sort of have to get familiar with the name. And when you've already got a guy who's been to New York and who's been on TV and who has sort of been circulated as a Heisman Trophy candidate for a couple of years now, these types of Heisman voters who are sort of the less in tune Heisman voters are going to know you better. So Monte Ball has this advantage coming into the year that he's very well known among the Heisman electorate. So anything he does, it's not going to be this, we've got to reintroduce ourselves, or he's got to reintroduce himself to the electorate. So at this point, he's purely a stats guy, and he had obviously incredible numbers last year. And that's actually probably the one thing he doesn't have going for him, is that his numbers were so good last year, he might have set himself up for the perception that he did not quite live up to his previous season. And if you look back in Heisman history, you won't find many, if any, cases where someone's Heisman Trophy winning season was worse or significantly worse than the previous season. So Herschel Walker won the Heisman in 1982 as a junior, and he ran for fewer yards than he did his sophomore year, but by that point it was sort of a career award on his behalf. So it's very rare for a guy to have a much worse season than he did the year before. And, through no fault of Monte Ball, he may not have the ability to have that kind of season again, just because of not having Russell Wilson and all the other things that go into scoring 39 touchdowns. You need a little bit of luck. You need a little bit of circumstances to play in your favor. So I think those are the things that are working against him.
Yeah, no, I could see Ball absolutely sort of, playing a Andrew Luck type role where he's coming in. Luck was the leading returning vote getter from 2010.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So, and like you said, there's no Russell Wilson. There's a couple other pieces missing from that offense. He could play just as big a role for Wisconsin and help in their success, but still, just because of the numbers, hurt himself in the Heisman. I will say though, where he and Luck are separate is it seems as though the Wisconsin Sports Information Department is going to work for him right now. I mean, this fall is for Ball, that campaign, everything, having him all dressed up for Big Ten Media Days, they seem to be really pushing that.
Yeah, they learned a lesson from last year when, their coach said, oh, we don't believe in running Heisman campaigns. Their plays get decided in the field. If they have great seasons in the field, that's how you win the Heisman. Well, I think that's a great example, a great sort of teachable moment for those who believe that Heisman campaigns are irrelevant, because Russell Wilson set the all-time NCAA record for passing efficiency and threw 33 touchdowns and led his team to the Big Ten title. And he had exactly, I believe he did not show up for the top eight of the Heisman vote. And Monte Ball scored 39 touchdowns on the season, or he eventually did. And he had an incredible regular season, and he had exactly 22 first-place votes. So it's not really a question of, hey, if you have a guy who's clearly superior statistically to the other guys, do we have to have a campaign? That's not the point. The point is, if you've got three or four guys who all have a case to be made for the Heisman, who all have had great seasons, who all play for teams that are, 11-1 or 12-0, who are all in the conversation for national honors, how do you decide which guy is the most deserving? And that is up to the school to say, look, this guy is the most deserving because of X, Y, and Z. And this helps the voters to differentiate between several very deserving candidates. I mean, if you look at last year, Robert Griffin III was very deserving, but so was Andrew Luck, and so was Trent Richardson, and so was Monty Ball. I mean, all those guys could have been a Heisman Trophy winner in almost any other year, but Robert Griffin III won, and people have to ask, why was that? Why did they pick Robert Griffin III from Baylor, of all places, over a guy who was the previous year's runner-up and who was going to be the first pick in the draft, or the guy from the national title winner? And the answer is that they looked at the story of each of those guys, and they determined that Robert Griffin III was the most deserving or was the most appealing, and the way they got that information was from the school. And so Wisconsin this year isn't going to make that same mistake. They've gone to the hilt for Monte Ball from the beginning, and they're going to, they're not going to make that same mistake twice, and that's a really smart move on their part.
Coming down the home stretch, number two on your Heisman watch for the 2012 season, we mentioned him earlier, Michigan quarterback Denard Robinson. Obviously, he got a chance to have some of the electrifying plays and sort of the sort of swagger. I feel like he could capture the spirit of the season if it's a big year for Michigan. What's working the most in his favor in your mind?
Yeah, I think sort of the things that work with Landry Jones' favor, in that he is the top player on a traditional power program that is known for putting out great players and Heisman Trophy winners. And like a Matt Barkley and like a Monte Ball, he has had Heisman votes before. He finished sixth in the 2010 vote. He's a guy who's been known to Heisman voters. He's well known across the country. He's in his fourth year as a player, third year as a starter. He's going to be a guy, and he's got the great nickname and the dreads. He's a recognizable player. He's not a guy that you have to think about for very long before you come up with his name if you ask someone to come up with some of the top players in college football. He's on the tip of people's tongues pretty quickly, and that's a big advantage when you're going forward in the Heisman race. His other big advantage is he sort of has the perfect schedule set up for a Heisman run, and starting out with the huge matchup with defending national champion Alabama in Dallas on September 1st. So that's the kind of game. It's high risk, high reward. And it's really, if you really think about it, it's low risk, high reward, because, if he doesn't win that game or Michigan doesn't win, I don't think they're going to ding him too much as a candidate. He could actually probably still recover. But if they do beat Alabama,
man,
he immediately vaults to the top of the Heisman chart.
Yeah, if he lights up the Alabama defense, which just and like you said, in the minds of these beat writers and these other voters that just don't get to watch every single game, they rely a lot on highlights, they rely a lot on hearsay and buzz and what they've seen in social media. All we think about when it comes to Alabama defense is the reason why Nick Saban has brought rings back to Tuscaloosa. And if he is able to have multiple touchdowns, especially, burn them through the air and with his feet against the, Alabama defense, I love his chances to keep that train rolling. And it's interesting. It's like you said, if it is a low risk, high reward, because the flip side of that is, it's like, well, it was the Alabama defense. They do bring it every year.
Exactly. It's a lot like Robert Griffin III going up against TCU in the first game last year. TCU certainly has been, if you look at it, look at the numbers, has been the dominant defensive team of the last 7 or 8 years. And what Robert Griffin III did against that defense, or at least the perception or the reputation of that defense, I think, started him off on the right foot with his Heisman race. Now, it didn't matter in the end that maybe that defense wasn't as good as some of those previous units. I mean, it still ended up being pretty good, but it really wasn't that dominant defense. They had lost a lot of guys.
It wasn't the Rose Bowl defense at all.
Yeah, exactly. It was still a solid defense, but especially early in the season, it wasn't that type of dominating defense. But at the time, voters didn't know that. They still always remember, they're always going to equate TCU with great defense. And the same way with Alabama, they lose a lot of great players from last year's defense. I mean, a lot of great players. And they may struggle early on. They may have some guys, no matter how talented they are, you're going up against Denard Robinson, who can, turn a bad play into a good play, and who can make some guys look pretty silly. And this is, again, one of the top two or three fastest quarterbacks ever to play the game. So, this could very well turn into a situation where maybe Alabama's not quite prepared, and he has a great game, and he gets sort of a bigger boost than he would normally would if people, you know, saw, you know, what was really going on with Alabama. So, but then again, it could be that Alabama ends up being another great defense, and you know, once he gets thwarted, people will say, well, you know, he didn't, like you said, it is the Alabama defense. So, and then he'll have a chance to recover, and there's 12 more games in the season, and with a guy like that, he can put up numbers running, numbers passing. And he does it in that, you know, sort of inimitable style. And I think he sort of has fun with it. And I think, you know, when you see him play, I think it's sort of infectious to watch. And I think that really plays a lot in his favor.
Yeah, that listen to sort of him talk after the Notre Dame game was, and like after that incredible Notre Dame game, you know, that was the moment for me where I was just sort of like, man, I felt bad when I said it out loud. I was like, I'm really glad this guy is not a top NFL prospect, because I would love to cover him another season.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's probably, to bring up his downside to his Heisman hopes. And that would probably be his durability and what he's gone through the last couple of years, as far as, you know, just carrying the load for that program. And I think, and one thing I forgot to touch upon is the fact that one of the narratives in his favor is that he's going to be seen as having helped rebound, you know, a traditional power. You know, they were just 3-9, whatever, 5-7 his first couple of years. And they went from that to 11-2, last year. And that's kind of a great story for a great program like Michigan. And he's seen as, you know, one of the catalysts for making that happen. So, but I think, you know, the durability factor, the fact that he's an undersized quarterback, the fact that he's the kind of guy who will not flinch from taking hits, and he sort of plays with reckless abandon, doesn't always play into his favor. And things are probably a little bit better for him now, because he's not playing in that pure spread with Rich Rod's offense. He's in his second year with the Al Borges offense, so he's probably going to be under a little more protection. And that's probably what affects his numbers a little more, but he's still going to have that ability to make big plays. And I still think he's going to probably get a few more hits under his belt. So the question is, can he survive a whole season? Can he put up the numbers throughout the whole season? And you know, will Michigan's offense, the way it's set up, allow him to have those kind of numbers?
Moving on. Now we got number one, the Heisman front runner in the initial Heisman watch, USC quarterback Matt Barkley. Chris, what is going in his favor as far as being yet another USC quarterback to win the stiff arm?
Yeah, there's a ton going in his favor. When you play for USC, especially in the last, 7 or 8 years, you're looking at, you know, especially being a USC quarterback, you're looking at one of the preeminent positions in college football. The USC quarterback has sort of become almost what the Notre Dame quarterback used to be. And it's almost become as powerful in the Heisman tradition as the USC tailback. There are some positions in college football that sort of capture the imagination of fans and media, you know, the Penn State linebacker, or the, you know, the big bruising Ohio State running back, or the Notre Dame quarterback, and the USC running back. Those were all sort of special positions that sort of had a little bit more cachet when it comes to the Heisman. But the last few years, you've had Carson Palmer and Matt Leinart and Mark Sanchez and now Barkley. So, you have a situation where Barkley came in as a youngster, and they weren't very good, and the team wasn't really seen as being very relevant, and they were under the cloud of NCAA sanctions, and he sort of stuck through, and you know, he really wasn't as good as he was hyped up to be early in his career, but to his credit, he stuck with it, came back for another year, has improved remarkably the last couple of years, or last year or so, and he set a Pac-12 record for touchdown passes last year. So he's got all the advantages, just like you're the governor of California, 1980, you know, you're Ronald Reagan, you know, coming from California to run for president, and you've got, you know, this huge advantage going into the race. And that's what Matt Barkley has. And obviously Matt Barkley still has to perform, and USC being a national title contender, they still got to win those games. But when you look at the receiving core he has around him, and the four or five guys returning on the offensive line, and that really deep tight end group, and then now you have 2,000-yard rushers, you have to like his chances to have kind of a juggernaut offense working with him. So I think he's going to put up the numbers. Being a USC quarterback, there's a big advantage, and having the narrative of helping rebound a program that was going through hard times is going to appeal to voters. So all that's going to work in his favor. It's just up to him to perform at this point.
Yeah, it really seems, you know, we've gone through all these. It seems like the only way that, you know, the thing that's going to go against him might just be the expectations, because this, everyone, you know, just has deemed USC as the team that can take, I mean, on that ESPN, the magazine college football cover, it's all about who's going to beat the SEC, and it says in big letters, we're looking at you Trojans. I mean, it seems as though if they're not going to be playing in the national championship game, he loses some first place votes from Heisman voters after the regular season.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he's the front runner, but I wouldn't necessarily call him by any means a lock. He's a guy who, going into the season, has all these advantages set that are on the table before him. The table is set, so to speak. So just as with any player, his table setting includes, a plate, a bowl, knife, fork, and spoon, a wine glass, a water glass, you know, and a napkin. Whereas, you know, whoever's number 10 in that table setting might just have a bowl. So he's got all these things working in his favor, and it's just a matter of whether he's going to sit down at the table and be able to digest everything that's coming his way. So, one thing working in his favor beyond all the sort of structural advantages he has in the Heisman race is he's got a coach who might be the most stats-conscious coach I've ever come across. I think you're going to see a lot of touchdown passes from within the 10-yard line at USC this year.
Oh, that stinks for Silas Red.
Well, yeah, I think Silas Red, is probably not going to be as much of a factor as people think. It's just my opinion on that one.
Oh, I got you. All right, well, Chris, that about wraps up on this this preseason edition. And if you don't mind, I'd like to have you back, and we can work in a regular Heisman update for all the fans and the listeners of the CBSSports.com College Football Podcast.
I'd love to do that, because there's going to be a lot of twists and turns in this thing as the year goes on, and just the perception of why things are happening, or why a certain person is leading in the race, or why they're not. Sometimes those perceptions get out there, and people don't get the right idea. So I'd love to come on and sort of contribute my point of view on what's going on with the race.
Absolutely. We'll plan on it. He is Chris Houston. You can follow him on Twitter at Heisman Pundit. If you go to CBSSports.com, college football, look for the Heisman Watch, or you can go /college football/Heisman. All those are ways that you can get to all of the material from Chris. And remember, you can get all of the CBSSports.com college football podcasts from the iTunes store. We put them all out there, and we only charge free 99. So just download as many of them as you want, subscribe, and we'll deliver them to you for free. Chris, I appreciate it. And everyone, thanks for tuning in.